This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We are slated to talk with Bill Schneider. For almost 20 years, he was CNN's chief political analyst. He's written a book about our time called How America Became Ungovernable. Bill Schneider will also discuss tonight's announcement from President Trump. The president is expected to unveil his choice for the successor to Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. According to reports this morning, there is a two-person race now for that post. Also on the show, Mary DeRusso of the Old State Capitol and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Walt Handelsman on a major exhibit featuring editorial cartoons that premieres this week at the Old State Capitol. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a great weekend. And your number is 877-217-5757 if you'd like to participate in the conversation. You're dialing locally. The number is 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And you can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Bill Schneider is our guest, a leading political analyst. Bill Schneider has covered American politics in every presidential election since 1964. His latest book is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. And he is here to talk about, of course, what's happening in our world of politics. And as we know, it's not so pretty right now. But tonight, there is a huge announcement coming from the President of the United States. Donald John Trump, the 45th American president, will announce his choice to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's expected, according to recent reports from major news outlets, to be between two people now, Brett Kavanaugh and Thomas Hardiman, both federal judges. And that would mean that Amy Coney Barrett of New Orleans would not be in the final cut if these reports are accurate. But Bill Schneider, it is a significant decision from the president, and then the fun really begins.
Yep, the Democrats are going to go to the mattresses, as they said in The Godfather. They're ready to fight this tooth and claw. Even though the odds are against Democrats, they're in favor of the confirmation of President Trump's choice. It's going to be a real Donnybrook on Capitol Hill in the Senate where the confirmation vote is being held. But the Republicans want to make it happen very quickly because they want the new Supreme Court justice confirmed before the midterm election.
Are there distinctions between the Merrick Garland nomination from President Obama in his final year, and of course the Republican majority in the Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, sat on this for more than a year, and Garland did not get a hearing, and ultimately Justice Neil Gorsuch was appointed to succeed Antonin Scalia. But now we have President Trump in year two of his administration nominating his second Supreme Court justice, if this one is approved. Is there a distinction, or is this just politics?
Well, it's always politics in a Supreme Court nomination, but there's a distinction here because the person that President Trump nominates is going to occupy Justice Kennedy's seat. Kennedy has been a swing vote on the court. He was appointed by a Republican president, and he often votes conservative, but he sometimes, particularly on social issues, and most particularly on issues of gay rights, he's voted with the liberals and created a liberal majority. This is a swing vote. So if Trump, as expected, appoints or nominates a conservative justice, that would mean a conservative majority on the court. And Democrats are very concerned about what this means for issues like abortion.
Yeah, Roe v. Wade seems to be the decision that most are focusing upon, but it could involve changes in certainly the Affordable Care Act. It could involve changes in any number of sectors of American life. It's not just Roe v. Wade, but that's the one that if it were overturned after being the law of the land for 45 years, the country would certainly react. It's the old law of physics, Bill Schneider.
Yeah. Well, what would happen is that you'd have some states in which abortion is legal, some states in which it's a crime. The country would be deeply divided over the issue of abortion. It would just be that much further from any kind of resolution.
877-217-5757. We're talking with one of the leading political analysts in our country for several decades, Bill Schneider, who spent two decades as the top political analyst at CNN, and his latest work is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. And a lot of the themes that you note in this book are certainly in play with this appointment to the high court.
Yes, that's right, because the division is mostly over social issues, which began really in the 1960s with the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in Vietnam. You had a division in the country. I call it the old America and the new America. The new America began to surface in the 60s with a lot of new groups voicing their concerns, young people, people who aren't religious, minorities, immigrants, gays. They were heard from for the first time, and there was a fierce backlash to the emergence of these new liberal voices. The backlash created the candidacy of Barry Goldwater, which, of course, did not work in 1964, but then it produced Richard Nixon and later Ronald Reagan. This fight between the backlash and the new America has been going on for decades.
You have many themes here that are worthy of exploration, and you try to explain the phenomenon of Donald Trump. You talk about how previous presidents tried to unite the country and failed, and in a way that led to the emergence of Trump as a national figure and ultimately the leader of the free world. How did it happen?
Trump is different from any other president we've ever had because he ran as a divider. He got elected as a divider, and he is governing as a divider. The division was there long before Trump. He didn't create the division. As I said in the book, it goes way back to the 1960s. But you had four presidents in a row before Donald Trump, each of whom promised to heal the division in the country. And they all failed. The first President Bush said he would be kinder and gentler. He got fired. Bill Clinton was a new Democrat and the third way. He got impeached. The second George Bush promised to be a uniter, not a divider. But once the war in Iraq was his policy, it divided the country even more. And, of course, President Obama got elected in 2008, mostly because of the financial crisis, but also because he promised there was no liberal America, there is no conservative America, there's just the United States of America. He was proved wrong. There is a liberal and a conservative America. Donald Trump never proposed to be a healer. That's not Donald Trump. He exploited the division. He saw it as an opportunity, and that is how he's governing.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk with Bill Schneider, an esteemed political analyst. He traces 50 years of presidential contests to explain how America has arrived at this standoff that we are now experiencing. The book is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable, from Simon & Schuster, and it is on sale now. Daryl on Airline Highway. Daryl, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning to you and your guests. The thing I wanted to mention was that we very often talk about the right to abortion. We talk about the Second Amendment, but the conservative courts have been very hostile to the Fourth Amendment. And a lot of these drug forfeiture laws where your property can be taken without any sort of due process, those are the rights that more Americans are going to be affected by, that conservative courts have been very hostile to the Fourth Amendment. And
all right. Thank you, Daryl. This justice, if President Trump gets the votes he needs, Bill Schneider is bound to be conservative. And many of these issues, like the one Daryl just enunciated, are at play. But In this case, is a Trump presidency any different than if Marco Rubio had been elected or if Jeb Bush had been elected?
Well, we don't know. But we do know that Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and most of the other Republicans were more wired into the Washington establishment. They had long histories in politics and in government. They knew the rules. Trump, his signature attitude is defiance. He defies the rules, he defies the establishment, he defies the leadership of his own party, and his supporters love it. He has a base, he has an army. It terrifies Republicans in Congress because if they cross Trump or criticize him, they realize he has an army that's going to come after them in primaries, and that army could destroy them. They destroyed Mark Sanford, a congressman from South Carolina this year, because he had been critical of Mr. Trump. So this is a whole new phenomenon in politics.
Penn in Lafayette. Penn, you're on Talk Louisiana with Bill Schneider.
Mr. Snyder, thank you for taking my question, first of all, and thank you for your very interesting premise. My question is, would you be willing, as my 10th grade teacher said, to compare and contrast, but to look at the template Ross Perot set forth and that I believe Donald Trump picked up on and implemented, which was there was going to be no third party, but he basically isolated elements of the Republican Party that have been dissatisfied to his advantage.
How do you see that? Does Penn have a point?
Yes, it's a very good point, because I've often compared Trump's appeal with Ross Perot's appeal. You know, they're both businessmen, business leaders, and an awful lot of Americans believe that we should run government like a business. I hear that all the time when I give talks to audiences. Someone will stand up and say, why can't we run government like a business? In business, you solve problems. You keep politics out of it, because everybody knows there's no politics in business. My goodness. But the fact is, you can't run government like a business for a very simple reason. Business is not a democracy. If business were a democracy, it would look like government. It would be divided. It would be a big mess. So the caller, I think, has a very good point. And what Perot and President Trump and others who have come in as populists have basically argued is politics is the enemy of problem solving. Many Americans believe that.
The book from our esteemed guest is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. We've got a bit more time with Bill Snyder, one of the leading political analysts in this country for a few decades, 20 years at CNN as their chief political analyst, and a book about the division in America that is quite forthcoming about where we are right now. We'll talk about it more with Bill Snyder after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Becca Dill's producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Bill Snyder is our guest, fabulous political analyst, and he is back in a big way with a book about American politics as we experience it today, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Please be brief in your comments, Marie and Eunice. Marie, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, thanks, Jim, for taking my call. My question to Bill is, why not have a constitutional amendment for term limits on the court and for term limits in Congress? I know we have our challenges in Louisiana now that we have term limits, but it seems to me that the Supreme Court decisions are controlling our federal elections, giving outsized power to both the courts and to the elected officials.
All right. Thank you, Marie. Bill, what about term limits for judges and members of Congress, Supreme Court justices?
Well, they are very, very popular. Supreme Court justices, as everyone knows, are appointed for life. Term limits have always passed. There was an orgy of term limits passed in 1990 before Bill Clinton became president. It's always seemed to me an odd solution, because voters have the ability to fire elected officials who are not doing their jobs or not doing a good job. But term limits is a way of saying we don't want to keep them on even if they're doing a great job. They have to go after a certain period of time. It's an expression of frustration by the voters that they want to impose term limits so that nobody becomes too entrenched in office.
You note that there is what you call an intensity factor in American politics, that even though polling numbers, something you're familiar with, show one thing, often the minority rules the day. How does that happen?
It happens because the minority are often single-issue voters on issues like guns or abortion. They care about one issue only. Other issues are secondary, whereas most voters, abortion or gun laws are important, but they have to compete with a lot of other issues. So that if you're a member of Congress and 75% of your constituents favor new gun laws, you are probably not going to support the new laws because you're not going to necessarily win the votes of many of the people who favor the laws, but you're going to lose all the votes from the one quarter of your constituents who oppose any new gun laws because they feel so intensely about the issue that it controls their vote. That's the power of single-issue voters.
And you note that in polling, the numbers, by the way, are still relatively good from pollsters, despite cell phones and the like, but polling has a very difficult time measuring intensity.
That's right. They try to do it all the time, but Normally, polls are useful for counting noses, how many people say yes, how many people say no. But what really matters and matters to office holders is how much do they care about the issue? Is this an issue that's really going to drive their votes or not? That's what's hard to measure.
The book is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Please be brief. Patrick on Blue Bonnet, you're on with Bill Schneider.
Hey, I got, when it comes to abortion, it's kind of a unique situation in that the rights of two people intersect and conflict with each other. The woman has a right to her body, yet the baby has a right to life. I mean, how do we condone murder? How is that legal? How can a doctor legally kill a baby?
All right. Well, that, Bill, is a way that many, not just Patrick, would frame this issue, and of course others would be deeply offended by that depiction of abortion.
That's right. If you truly believe abortion is murder, that's what drives people to say it has to be against the law. I once heard a Catholic bishop, I had a discussion on abortion with a Catholic bishop, and he made an interesting point. He said, suppose I tell you that I'm okay with human slavery, and I want to go out and buy a slave, but you disagree. So why don't we just agree to disagree and allow slavery in this country? He said, we in the church feel the same way about abortion. We believe that an unborn child has a right to life, and that right to life can't be impinged. If you truly believe that, and most people, some Americans do, some Americans don't, but if you truly believe that, then there is no possibility of a compromise. The interesting thing about the abortion issue is it hasn't changed in over 40 years. Americans were divided on abortion when Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973, and they're just as divided now.
877-217-5757 is your number. In our remaining time with Bill Schneider, the book is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, sir. I think if you look at the time, starting in, I think, 1988, when hate radio, when right-wing talk radio started coming out and putting out a lot of propaganda, up until the time that Congress has now made it, given permission for us to sell our oil on the open market, and now there are five new refineries that have been built in our country since 2012, and our oil is out there being sold out. I think that's one of the things that's going on with just shoveling all our resources out of here and, you know, big fire sale. Goodbye, America.
All right. The president certainly is making his imprint on the economy and on American policy when it comes to things of this kind.
That's right. It's a very big imprint. He's trying to promote buying American, manufacturing things in the United States. It's helping some industries, but it's hurting some industries who find themselves suddenly with higher prices because imports are now being taxed by tariffs. So there's a huge controversy over the president's trade policy, which could make it more difficult and more expensive for certain industries to operate.
I like this perspective you have about elections. You say the outcome of every election, no matter how big or small, is determined by whether the challenger can offer voters something they want that they are not getting from the incumbent.
That's right. In 1968, Richard Nixon was dug up from the political graveyard. ABC had run a documentary called The Political Obituary of Richard Nixon because he offered something people wanted, order in a country that was being torn apart. After Watergate, Jimmy Carter came along and he offered morality after Watergate. I will never lie to you. In 2008, Barack Obama proposed to be a unifier in a country that was very deeply divided. Obama was the un-Bush, the un-George W. Bush. And then what happens? We elected Donald Trump. Trump is the un-Obama, the opposite of Obama. You can't think of anyone as different from Barack Obama as Donald Trump is.
You note that white working class men see political correctness as a way of shutting them out, and ultimately many voted for Donald Trump, giving him an overwhelming majority in the last presidential election. But what about white women? How did he carry the majority of white women?
He did carry them. White women, all whites, tend to vote Republican these days. Democrats depend on big margins among minorities. Democrats do better among women than among men, and white women are more likely to vote for a Democrat than white men are, although a small majority of white women did vote for Donald Trump. That had to do with being white more than it had to do with being women. there's a gender gap in American politics. It's been there for a long time, and it's been growing. Women are committed to the safety net. Women have begun to achieve economic independence in this country only in the last 20 or 30 years, and they feel that they want the government to be there with a safety net, particularly if they're raising families. The safety net is much more important to women, whereas men are more willing to take risks. They take chances. They're bolder, and they don't care as much about the safety net.
Well, the court could veer rightward in a way that it is not in many times, at any time in recent American history. But where is the country going as a whole as far as its politics? Is it moving left or right?
It's not moving. That's why we're ungovernable. We have a standoff between the left and the right. You know, and elections have tended since 2000 to be extremely close. We've twice elected a president who did not win the popular vote but won the Electoral College. That's what the standoff means. How do we get out of this mess? Generally speaking, in all of our history, what happens is a crisis. We hope it's a good crisis. I don't know what a good crisis means exactly, but a crisis where we advance the interests of the country. Civil rights was that kind of a crisis in the 1960s. It was bloody, it was painful, but the country ended up ahead. Well, the dirty little secret of American politics is this country is easy to govern when there's a crisis, which means an overwhelming sense of public urgency. When things are normal and there's no crisis in the country, then we get gridlocked, then things break down.
The book from Bill Schneider, who, as you can hear, is still at the top of his game, is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Congratulations on your fine work and certainly some insights that I think are worthy of exploration for anybody who has an interest in our country and especially an interest in politics. Thank you, Bill Schneider.
My pleasure.
This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And our guests at this time are Mary DeRusso of the Old State Capitol and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Walt Handelsman of The Advocate. Beginning this month, the Old State Capitol is showing the traveling exhibit lines with power and purpose, editorial cartoons. The exhibit runs through September 29th as a collection of early 20th century editorial cartoons from metropolitan newspapers around the country, and we have two people with a passion about this. And if you haven't been to the Old State Capitol, let's start with Mary DeRusso. She's been holding court there for some time. Mary, your thoughts about this major exhibit at this beautiful, historic, and treasured facility?
Well, thank you, Jim, and thanks so much for having us on the program. It's a wonderful exhibit, and it couldn't be more suited to the Old State Capitol, where, of course, we spend all of our time talking about Louisiana history and democracy and trying to keep people engaged in the democratic process. And so this is a wonderful exhibition. It has original drawings from just some fabulous cartoonists from back in the day, including Herb Block, who John Stewart called him a touchstone of modern-day political satire. And it really, it's amazing to me how so many of the subjects still resonate today, industry versus labor, relations between the rich and poor, poor treatment of the nation's war veterans. I mean, it's really like we're just recycling some of these topics over and over again. So we're really excited about it, and we're really thrilled to have Walt Handelsman come into the Old State Capitol Wednesday evening. We're having a little reception at 5:30, and then he's going to do a program at 6. And as you know, Walt is featured in The Advocate, and but also he's syndicated internationally. So we are thrilled to have a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner right here in our own hometown.
Well, Walt does great work, and Pulitzers aren't handed out like candy. And he will be a big part of the Wednesday night 5:30 exhibit start.
That's correct.
At the Old State Capitol. And Walt Handelsman, I'm sure you're familiar with what people will see, and I hear it's quite a montage of great work from people from years ago.
Well, I looked at the preview stuff online, and it just looks great. I love looking at this stuff, and we have an annual, we, the editorial cartoonists of America, have a yearly convention. And back in the day when there were lots more cartoonists, it was quite a big deal. And we had hundreds of people that would show up, and they often had shows of either older stuff, and I'm old enough to remember meeting Herb Block on several occasions at these conventions. And, you know, you could just sit down with them, and they would go over your work, and you could look at some of the master's work, and it was just great. So I was reminded of that when I looked back at some of these cartoons that they're promoting the event online, and they're just great. They're great. Great stuff. It's so interesting for me as an artist to look at the different styles. Mm-hmm. But as Mary said, you know, one of the sad things about drawing editorial cartoons for as long as I have is that you do indeed see issues that may have changed a tiny little bit, but you're basically drawing cartoons on the same issues. And it's a little bit discouraging to think that in some cases we haven't moved forward. But it is interesting to look at the old cartoons, and cartooning back in the day was so huge. Of course, there was no social media. In many cases, when you look back at these cartoons, there was no television. So editorial cartooning at the time, some of these older ones, that was like the most satire that anyone saw. They were shocking satire. And these were, you know, some of them were very hard-hitting, and others were somewhat tame. But literally the idea of seeing a character that you knew, whether it was your governor, a senator, the president, a sports figure, drawn in a cartoon with someone saying a punchline about them, or they speaking a punchline, was really shocking. Uh-huh. And they ran huge. They ran, you know, on top of the fold on the front page of the newspaper. So it was a very, very influential art form, and there were lots of cartoonists at the time doing very, very good work, including in Louisiana. I think probably the most well-known cartoonist was John Chase, and I have a couple of books of his. It's just amazing stuff. It's for me as a cartoonist, mm-hmm. it's really fun to look back at them. So I'm looking forward to the exhibit, as well as giving a short presentation about modern day cartooning, as well as showing some animations.
When did cartoonists start zoning in on presidents? It seems like every cartoonist wants to have his or her specialized view based on the art of a president of the United States.
Well, I think that's been going on since somebody picked up a pen and started drawing editorial cartoons. I guess you could say there was somewhat of a split. It's probably not accurate to say a split, but I would say that back in the day, the cartoonists that weren't syndicated were probably doing a lot fewer national cartoons. The cartoonists, and I'm talking about in the 50s and 60s that were syndicated, were probably doing more national cartoons, which of course meant drawing more national figures. But at the end of the day, whoever the president is always going to be the main subject of political cartoons. So I've been drawing cartoons since the very end of the Jimmy Carter presidency, when I was just kind of toying with cartooning. I was a kid. And then, of course, Ronald Reagan was the main character in cartoons. And also, by the way, the main character in the news.
Yes.
You know, and from there it was George Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. So, I mean, you know, when people say to me and to cartoonists in particular, gosh, you pick so much on Donald Trump. Even if Donald Trump were kind of a calm, within the range of normal political behavior type of president, which he's not. He's a caricature of himself, and we all know that. He would still be the number one feature in editorial cartoons. The fact that he tweets and is so boisterous and says so many things just makes it a certainty that he's going to be the feature in many, many editorial cartoons. This is not something specific to Donald Trump. This has always been the case. They are the main characters in the drama that is the political drama being played out across the nation, and that it will continue to be that way.
Do you have a favorite president, Walt, of those you've drawn? And we're talking about Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, Obama, Trump. You've done them all.
I mean, there were each one of them had their own aspects that were interesting. And, just in terms of drawing stuff, I mean, Ronald Reagan was one of the first ones, really the first president when I had a job drawing this. So he had, talking about things going round and round. So he had this vision of Star Wars. He had his battle with his peace battle with Gorbachev. He had the great bouffant hair that we drew. So now we have Donald Trump talking about the Space Force, which reminded me of when Ronald Reagan talked about what they called back in the day Star Wars. And so you had Reagan was quite a charismatic character. As a matter of fact, he invited us to the White House. We got to go to the White House and see Ronald Reagan. And he had all of the cartoonists in the Rose Garden for a speech. And this shows you he had a great sense of humor with cartooning very quickly. He had something that he called the cartoon. There was no Internet. He had a thing called the Friday Follies put together. And what they would do is someone on his staff would gather up all the cartoons that they saw in the nation's newspapers, and they would copy them. And then they would put them in a pamphlet with a staple, and they would probably have 100 of them passed out around the White House, including one that went on the Oval Office desk. And Ronald Reagan loved the cartoons. I mean, he was in all of them, but he had a great sense of humor. So he invited us to the White House, and he had taken a bunch of cartoons and blown them up, someone in the staff had, onto giant cardboard, and he put them up on an easel in front of us all, and he filled in the word balloons, turning all the jokes on us. It was really funny. And later on in my career, and this was sort of a funny, weird thing that happened, I drew a cartoon about George H.W. Bush and Saddam Hussein. It was a simple cartoon. The first Gulf War had just started, and it was a cartoon of George H.W. Bush in panel one, labeled Patriot, and Saddam Hussein in the second panel, labeled Scud. And it was just a kind of a very, very simple cartoon about the war had begun. Saddam was shooting off these Scud missiles. Everyone was talking about them. So I got a call the next day, and someone said, this is so-and-so calling for President Bush. So, of course, being a jaded journalist that I am, I immediately gave them a hard time. I thought it was a friend of mine in the newsroom at the time, Speak Union at the time. And she said, no, this is Patty Prescott, and I am President George Bush's personal secretary, and he really liked the cartoon. He'd like a copy of it. And I said, how about this? I'm happy to send him a cartoon. Would you ask him to send me the Friday Follies? This is the Reagan thing that continued on during the Bush administration. The Friday Follies front cover that cartoon had run on. Would you have him sign it for me? So sure enough, and I'm looking at it as we speak, he sent me the cover of the Friday Follies with his name signed on it. And he was well known for sending little thank you cards to people. This is George H.W. Bush, the president. And inside this package came a little thank you note from the president of the United States. And the coolest thing about the whole thing is there's a business card. And the business card is just a regular size business card in very elegant script. It just says, the president. There's no address. There's no phone number. He's the president.
My. We'll talk more with Walt Handelsman and Mary DeRusso when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is producing, and we're spending a bit more time with Mary DeRusso of the Old State Capitol and Walt Handelsman, the two-time Pulitzer-winning editorial cartoonist. He won in 1997 with the Times-Picayune and in 2007 for Newsday. He returned to Louisiana 5 years ago to join forces with the Advocate of Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Lafayette, and parts unknown. The Old State Capitol is located at 100 North Boulevard, and it's been around since the mid-19th century. The current Capitol Tower building was constructed in the late 20s and early 30s, opening in 1932, but the Old State Capitol has been refurbished and is in grand splendor. If you haven't been there, that's worth a visit. And this week, major exhibit, which will be on display through September, of editorial cartoons is now available for public consumption. And 5:30 Wednesday, two nights from tonight, Walt Handelsman, the two-time Pulitzer winner, will be your guide through these editorial cartoons, and I'm sure we'll get his take on how the business works and get some ideas about contemporary editorial work as well from Walt Handelsman. And Mary DeRusso, I suspect on a given day, some days are much busier than others at the old state capitol, but this one on Wednesday should be quite a day for foot traffic.
We hope that we're just going to have a great turnout, but you're right. We have a lot of people that come through the old state capitol. We probably see 60,000 people a year and lots of school groups and riverboat guests and tons of international guests. People come there from all over the world. I worked on Saturday, and we had people from the Netherlands and from Vietnam, and you just never know who's going to come through the door. And we love being Louisiana's storyteller. And, you know, politics is, you know, almost like a sport here. And so we have a lot to talk about at the old state capitol. And we're just thrilled that we have this exhibit because it really, I think it just has a great appeal to it. And it's really funny, Jim, it's not just necessarily political cartoons where editorial cartoonists have made their mark. I mean, the reason we have images of Santa Claus and Uncle Sam are because they appeared in editorial cartoons. And to me, one of the fascinating things about the cartoonists are that they are able to boil down these subject matters into an illustration that quickly allows the viewer to take in an idea and a concept. And I can't imagine how you do that.
Yeah.
But it's very – and honestly – when we were talking about the golden age of these cartoons, when there were many, many major metropolitan newspapers, you know, really it goes to exactly what Walt said. There wasn't social media, and this was a way that a lot of people really got their information and could see these subjects discussed and in a way that they could quickly grasp.
And Walt, Heather in the Garden District asked why so many editorial cartoonists focus on the ears of the President of the United States. What about drawing the ears of, I know that the ears of Bush, number two, and Obama were featured a lot. Is that true of every president or just a select few?
You know, I really don't know what Donald Trump's ears look like because his hair covers the top two-thirds of his ear. So I just draw the little earlobe sticking out beside the hair that's wisping back towards the longer hair in the back.
Yeah. Well, he's,
you know, every president has a, so Ronald Reagan had the bouffant, George W. Bush had an interesting hairline. It kind of went up like a light bulb and then it had a very high part. Bill Clinton started off with a little cotton ball haircut, and then that finished up with the cotton ball haircut, a kiss on his cheek, and a cigar in his mouth every time I drew him. So Bill Clinton was, you know, the Monica Lewinsky thing was kind of the craziest thing I think all cartoonists, and for that matter, newspaper editors had to deal with in terms of the kind of stuff we were putting in newspapers. George W. Bush did have big ears, which were used in metaphors many, many times. My drawing of Obama, he had rather round, big ears. I also elongated his face and gave him a very long chin. And Donald Trump is pretty easy to draw now that it's been a year and a half, and he's obviously, as we discussed earlier, very well known. He's got the bright colored hair, and the hair is everything with the character, as well as the lips and the shape of the shape of the face. So there's always something.
When you won your first Pulitzer in '97, that was a Clinton year. I suspect he was in some of the entries that the judges looked at.
He was, also, so when you win in '97, it's actually for work in '96. So you win it in April or early May, but it's for a body of work in 1996. And being that it was 1996, it was a political election year. which to me are the most fun years, because you know, both sides are doing crazy things. You have all these personal characters that you're dealing with. In that year, we had Ross Perot, who was a feature in many of my cartoons, and Bill Clinton.
Bob Dole.
I believe, and I believe in 96 he ran against Bob Dole. And so, you know, it's just rich with all kinds of stuff. And then I believe there were some local cartoons in that entry. It's an entry of 20 cartoons, some stuff about crime and other things like that. And then 10 years later in 2007 was also riffing off of the year 2006, which was also an election year. So I love drawing cartoons during election years. Everyone's very plugged in. The politicians are running around the country, inevitably making mistakes, which are funny, and we get to pick on them. You have a bunch of personal characters. So it's always invigorating and exciting to do election year cartooning.
Well, come Wednesday, 5:30, Walt Handelsman will be holding court, and you'll get quite a tour of editorial cartoons. And this exhibit will show, for a few months, Mary DeRusso, but I know you'd like to get as many people who can make it, as long as the facility can hold the throng that will be there. But what do you have to do to be part of Wednesday's festivities?
You just have to show up, Jim. The doors will be open, and like I say, we're going to have a little reception from 5:30 to 6 and start Walt's presentation at 6, but the exhibit will be open, and people can walk through, and don't worry about us running out of room. We have the House chamber, and we have the Senate for overflow if we need it. So just come down. If you want to check our website, for more details, you can about the show. It's www.LouisianaOldStateCapital.org.
Well, thank you, Mary DeRusso, and it's always a pleasure to visit with you and with you,
thank
Walt
you
Handelsman.
Much.
Congratulations, Walt, on your continuing exceptional work.
Well, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing folks on Wednesday.
That's a deal.
That's right. Thanks so much. Thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And a few notes. Tonight, 8 o'clock, the president is slated to make his announcement to the High Court. And CBS is reporting that it's down to Brett Kavanaugh, judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and Thomas Hardiman, judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Kavanaugh is 53 years old, as is Hardiman. In fact, yesterday was Hardiman's birthday. So they are not as young as some people thought Trump would go. Remember when Clarence Thomas was appointed, he was all of 43 years old. They're 53, but that means they could be on the court easily for 25 or 30 years if they live a normal life. Hardiman was a runner-up when Gorsuch was chosen not so long ago. He's a graduate of the University of Notre Dame and of Georgetown Law. Not an Ivy Leaguer, but certainly part of the Northeast elite. And Kavanaugh is a graduate of Yale University, both his BA and his law degree from Yale University. He is a full-fledged Ivy Leaguer and served for George W. Bush. And both were appointed by the second President Bush. So President Trump's had his differences with the Bush administration, but both of these people presumably would be on the short list if Jeb Bush were the president of the United States. We'll see. 8 o'clock tonight, and of course it'll be carried by WRKF. Do want to note that fine gentleman, exceptionally talented man, Howard Arsenault, gentleman I went to school with at LSU. We were in some of the same journalism classes, worked at the Reveille together, and Howard Arsenault, 60 years old, died a few days ago of kidney cancer. It was a fight that swept him away pretty quickly, but he fought it valiantly, and there will be services tonight at 5 o'clock at Grace Episcopal Church in St. Francisville, visitation from 3 to 5 p.m. for Howard Arsenault. Aaron Nola, the LSU stalwart who won 30 games and lost 6 with the Tigers of Paul Menary, went to the Philadelphia Phillies in the draft of 2014. He's on the Major League All-Star team. He'll be pitching for the National League, a record of 11-2. He's pitching tonight against the Mets in New York. And Alex Bregman, his former teammate, is also on the team with 17 home runs, 29 doubles for the Houston Astros. So two pulmonary protégés will be representing the National League in the All-Star Game 1 week from tomorrow night. Until tomorrow, for Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.